The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons, and on this week's show, we'll be finding out if the man who puts terror into every McDonald's manager's heart can find a man who in turn has terrorised the United States of America. Yes, Morgan Spurlock's latest documentary follows him as he sets out to find Osama bin Laden. And Newcastle's finest, director Neil Marshall, has written and directed a sci-fi extravaganza which will do very little for Anglo-Scottish relations. Doomsday stars Bob Hoskins, Malcolm McDowell and Rona Mitra, and Neil Marshall joins me too. Also reviewing this week's releases is The Guardian's Zan Brooks. It's all to come on Film Weekly. But first, Morgan Spurlock's hit documentary Super Size Me demonstrated the harm of a diet consisting solely of junk food. It made him a household name and forced the corporate giant McDonald's onto the defensive. Spurlock's second documentary is yet another tale of the small guy, Morgan Spurlock himself, taking on a big guy, in this case, Osama bin Laden. Yes, the purpose of this documentary, Where in the World is Osama bin Laden, is given away in the title. Or is it?
I'm looking for Osama bin Laden. Why is that funny?
We don't know whether he's in a cave with the door shut.
I was wondering if we could ask you a question.
No. Our cave with the door open.
I got a tip on where to find his uncle, Mahfouz Azam.
You wouldn't turn him in for the $25 million?
But I'm a wanderlust king.
It's impossible. Mission is impossible.
This is hardcore Taliban country.
There's 21 guys here with guns.
When whoever's escorting you says, let's go, it means go now.
We ask every time,
hey, you guys know where Osama's at?
And they always point.
Jitadai Osama.
So that way.
Where in the world is Osama?
And with me now in the film pod is Morgan Spurlock. Welcome to Film Weekly, Morgan.
Thanks for having me.
Absolute pleasure. Lovely to see you. Looking slim. You're looking well.
Yeah, Alex has done a good job of cleaning me out. You know, she got me back to my fighting weight.
Because, each time you do a documentary, you have to take on some kind of physical challenge, not just a kind of, a news challenge or a story challenge. It's got to hurt.
Yeah, my wife's had enough of that. She's drawing a line in the sand right now.
Well, there's plenty of sand in your film, Where in the World is Osama bin Laden. Why in the world did you decide to find Osama bin Laden?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is one of those films and one of those ideas and questions that everybody where I live in New York City has asked, ever since 9/11, that this guy's still out there. Why haven't we found him? Why haven't we brought him in? And as we started kind of talking about this film and trying to figure out how do you even go about finding somebody like this, where do you go? Who do we want to talk to? We found out my wife was pregnant and we were about 2 months into kind of the pre-production process. And at that point, the film really shifted for me. And, it wasn't just about where is he? Why haven't we found him? But also, what kind of world am I about to bring a kid into?
Yeah. Was this actually what you were thinking? Is this how the next project came organically? Because after you'd taken on McDonald's and, let me say, changed their entire color scheme and menu and thought processes while you're at it, I mean, how did you sort of decide, right, who I'm going to do next?
Yeah, well, no, it was kind of, with the ideas for films and TV shows that we have kind of come out of anywhere, a newspaper, television, review. We get the idea from Super Size Me off of a news story on television. We had just finished our first season of the TV show 30 Days that airs here in the UK on More4, and we were trying to figure out what movie would be next, and that's when this news story came on about Osama had just put out a tape, and suddenly he was everywhere, and the pundits on television were like, why haven't we caught him? He's just taunting us again. Why haven't we brought him to justice? Where in the world's Osama bin Laden? And I was like, that's a good question. That's a good movie. And so then the light came on, and I called up my co-writer and co-producer, Jeremy Chilnick, and we went from there.
Did you ever think that you would find him?
Well, you don't buy a lottery ticket thinking you're going to lose. We knew that the odds were incredibly against us, 20, 30 million to one. But maybe you'll be the one. Maybe I'll be that guy, we knew it was, going to be close to impossible.
Yeah. I mean, obviously in the film, I don't think it's giving anything away to anyone who hasn't seen anything that you don't really
find, we don't find,
find
him.
You don't find him. You spoiled it.
I spoiled it. I ruined it. We didn't find him. I didn't get the Tiger Woods golf check at the end of the rainbow. I didn't get the $25 million. For me, and one of the reasons we dove into this film was the journey and the things we discovered, things we uncover about Osama bin Laden and what created him and what continues to push people towards him. This whole process of trying to find him, we thought would be as interesting as finding him. And it turns out it is.
Had you got anything prepared in case you did find him?
A big net, a really large net and a teleportation machine so that I could throw it over him and be back in New York City quickly.
Yeah, because getting him through customs would be like
a little hard. Yeah.
Who's the guy in the case?
What's that really? Why do you have such a large trunk? And why is it moaning? You know, for us, we wanted to, yeah, if that would happen, if you would actually get the moment or the chance to sit down and, you know, and ask him a question, you know, for us, it was, you know, just, you know, very simple. You know, how does this end? How does it stop? You know, how can this all come to a close? And maybe you get a real answer, you know, something that was actually made sense, you know, of steps that could be made. But, you know, you would probably end up with something that was just like 8 buckets of crazy.
Mm. Yeah. Now, I mean, it's obvious to anyone, I think, even before you start, even from the film's poster, that Osama bin Laden isn't really the issue here, is he? I mean, you say that people in New York, where is this guy? Why haven't we brought him in? Yeah. That's not going to slake anyone's thirst, is it? When you do find him and bring him to justice.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think for me, it's really finding out as we've kind of dove into this global war on terror and the things that you start to see over the course of this journey of kind of what is continuing to happen, you know, in these countries where, you know, in the United States, we have one version of what's overseas and the people that live overseas. And this is what dominates the press and dominates television. It's the guy who's burning the flag and wearing the mask and we hate America. And they're burning the president of the day in effigy. And I think that, you know, what we start to discover along the way is a vastly different image.
Are you a much traveled man? I mean, you kind of, I'm going to say, affect some kind of innocence as you go around the Middle East.
Well, I've never been to the Middle East. And I think anybody who's never been there in this part of the world, and especially in a lot of these cultures, it is very new and different. And you have to tread lightly at times. And so, you know, a lot of this is, you know, is genuine because you don't want to offend somebody, and especially in certain parts of the world, especially places where you could potentially be kidnapped and have your head lopped off. You know, you don't want to say anything that could put you on a fast track to that.
Did you find any McDonald's while you were on your travels?
Oh, of course. Yeah, I found them, but I didn't eat in them.
Obviously, your film, it seemed to me, made some kind of companion piece to Michael Moore, a McDonald's-loving documentary. Right. Tony puts himself in documentaries.
Yeah.
You're going to inevitably be compared to him, I think, just because you have sort of similar styles. You use right. cartoon exposition here in this film, as he did in Fahrenheit 9/11.
Yeah.
He actually sort of turned his anger on Bush.
Right.
You seem to have focused yours on the East rather than on the home front. Made you turn outwards?
Well, I think it would have been very easy to kind of jump on a Bush, you know, a Bush bash bandwagon at this point, you know, but also it's easy now. It's like, you know, why just pile on? And the guy's going to be out of office in like, you know, 8-9 months. You know, for me, we need to start looking ahead. What's next? You know, what does the person who gets in that office next really need to start to contend with? And I think those are the pieces of the puzzle you start to see us talking about. U.S. foreign policy, how we're viewed in the Middle East, you know, how people, you know, there was a time when America used to kind of be put up on a pedestal and looked at as this beacon of hope and democracy, and that's not the case anymore. You know, our image has been tarnished, you know, not beyond repair, but it's
sure.
bad.
I mean, being not American and being here, I kind of know that your image has tarnished a bit because, you know.
You hear it every day.
Exactly. Yeah. Frankly, you're tarnished.
Well, we dragged you guys down with us a little bit.
Well, yeah, well, exactly. I don't know if it was you affecting it. Did you know quite how bad the reputation was abroad?
Well, but it's one of those things that you hear on television, but it's different from sitting in your living room. It's like, oh, click, and you turn over. And I'm going to watch Jon Stewart now or South Park or something else. These guys are crazy. Click. You can leave it. It's much different being stuck in someone's house in their living room, sitting at their dinner table, and you can't leave.
It's obviously a very serious situation that you're dealing with, a very serious political question, the political question of our day.
Yeah.
What made you go into it slightly satirically? Let's go for a cartoonish aspect, a comic aspect.
Right. Well, for me, you know, I want to try and make films for people who normally wouldn't go see a documentary film. Super Size Me was seen by audiences that never went to see documentary films.
The 8th biggest documentary of all time.
Yeah, pretty crazy. Amazing. But yeah, so the goal for me was to continue to try and tap into that audience, to get young kids, young adults. You know, there were 12, 13, 14-year-old kids that went to see Super Size Me, and we're trying to continue to get people like that into this type of a conversation, get them engaged, and try and make it fun and interesting and make it something that parents and kids both can go to. You know, you can build a bridge, you know, between these two age groups. And I think the film does a great job of that.
With Super Size Me, you had a fantastic effect not only on your own physicality and on your wife's menus, on the McDonald's menus. I mean, I walked past one on the way to the studio today. It's now green. They've changed the color. They've got chicken Caesar wraps. They've got salads in there. And it is all because of you. I know it's a hell of an achievement.
They wouldn't agree with that.
No, they wouldn't. They would say, "Oh, we were just about to do it anyway. Some more salad with that." So, they got scared. You showed up. Something a tremendous achievement. You must be quite proud of that still.
Well, the thing that I think I'm most proud about Super Size Me is the people that I meet every day and how it affected individuals. Like, there was a guy the last time I was in London who flagged me across the street in Soho and ran across 3 lanes of traffic just so he could pull a picture out of his wallet and show it to me. And he's like, "All because of your movie. Look, that was me 6 stone ago." You know, and it's all because of you, and I meet parents who, you know, they started cooking at home and they don't eat out. You know, now they only eat out once a week, and people who started exercising in schools that changed their school lunch programs after they saw the film. I mean, for me, those are much more incredible things that happened, you know, where people took responsibility and said, I'm going to change my life. And so the things that have happened after this film, I mean, it's the same. Those are the same types of things that I'm gauging it against. You know, there was a kid who saw the movie at Sundance when it premiered there who was like 20 years old. His parents tell him, you can't travel overseas. It's so dangerous. Everyone hates Americans. Something terrible will happen to you. And as soon as he saw the film, he came to tell me that I'm going to go get a passport as soon as I get home. I have to find out for myself. You know, things like that.
So that would be the equivalent of McDonald's changing their menu for you would be more Americans getting to know the Middle East.
I think not just Americans, but just, you know, people in general becoming a part of this conversation. You know, there was a great line in the film where Nadia Yassin, who's an Islamist activist in Morocco, says, we as individuals need to start reaching beyond our political leaders. You know, we need to start connecting as civilians, building bridges between our communities as civilians. You know, those are the things that need to start happening. And if from this film, little things like that start, you know, ticking away, that's incredible.
What next then for this film? Because I know you're going to the Cannes Film Festival. Is that with Where in the World Is the Soul of
Man? No, it's not. Like, we have a film that one of the things that's happened after Supersize Me is it's we've been really blessed and been able to, like, help other filmmakers, which is exciting. And we've helped other filmmakers in the States produce films. And there's a movie that's called The Third Wave that Sean Penn fell in love with. And he's hosting a special presidential screening at Cannes of this film, which is a movie.
In a presidential suite.
Yeah, it's very nice. Yeah, it's kind of, I feel kind of swanky and important. And so we're flying over to Cannes for this movie that basically is about these four people who, after the tsunami hit Sri Lanka, they had to fly there. They just felt this calling to be there, and they met at the airport and drove down the coast, and over the course of like 6 to 8 months, these four people rebuilt an entire village and saved thousands of people's lives. And with everything that's even happening in Burma right now, I mean, there's an incredible idea to this importance of volunteerism and thinking beyond yourself, and it's a beautiful movie. So I mean, I'm just excited to get to be there.
You're gonna sit next to Sean Penn?
Maybe.
Yeah,
I hope
hop
so
up on the, I'll, hop
yeah,
up on the seat.
Exactly. I'm gonna put my hand on his knee and be like, thank you, Mr. Penn.
Well, that'd be amazing. Maybe the rest of the jury as well, because you've got Natalie Portman in there. You've got a fantastic jury.
All kinds of fancy people, yeah. I don't know what to do with myself. I got to get a tux.
Just finally, Morgan, obviously in the film, your wife plays a big part in it. She seems to have been subsumed into your world, whether she likes it or not. Charming lady. I've met her several times myself. Yeah. And you have a baby in the film.
Yeah.
How are they?
Yeah, they're both great. You know, Alex is the most patient, understanding, supportive wives ever. Like, every year she should get the Wife of the Year sash and crown for putting up with me and the stuff I like to do. And our little boy, you know, he's like 17 months now. He's big. He's running around and talking, and it's incredible. It's the greatest thing that's ever happened to me.
Well, congratulations to you. Thank you. Great company in the pod, a great company on screen as well. Morgan Spurlock, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Morgan Spurlock there. Joining me now to review this week's releases is Zan Brooks, editor of The Guardian Film Online. This week we'll be looking at Where in the World Is Osama Bin Laden, Speed Racers and Doomsday. So let's start with Morgan Spurlock's Where in the World Is Osama Bin Laden, Zan. We've heard from Morgan earlier in the show. I mean, people are looking forward to this. You know, it was the eighth biggest documentary of all time, Supersize Me. Can he possibly match that?
In a word, no. I'm glad I can say this now that he's safely out of the pod. I mean, he's a very amiable presence, Morgan Spurlock, and I'm quite happy to spend time in his company. But I'm not quite sure he's the man for this kind of mission. this is a tall order. Possibly the title is a bit of a red herring. Without giving too much away, he's never going to find Osama bin Laden, and maybe that's not what the film's about. It's more about the world that bin Laden lives in, the world that we all live in. And there's a slight kind of travelogue quality to this film of the sort of the bumbling American wandering around the danger zones of our current 21st century world and wondering why we can't all kind of get along.
He surely is affecting a kind of Condé-like innocence as he does go around, which Michael Moore did sort of roughly the same in his last Sicko, when he went around the various health services of the world to compare them to America. What do you think Morgan was trying to go for here? Did you get a sense as a viewer that there was a purpose to this? I felt he was goofing around rather too much with a subject that's actually very serious.
Yeah, Michael Moore goofs around, but like him or loathe him, Michael Moore kind of is fired up by righteous, sometimes self-righteous rage, and that gives his film a kind of punch and a drive, whereas Morgan Spurlock isn't that kind of filmmaker. He's more the sort of the bumbling, cheery best mate who kind of, you know, wanders around and has kind of slightly bumbling encounters. The other issue in this film is his wife's pregnancy and what kind of a world is he bringing his son into, and will he finish the film in time to get back for his son's birth, which is obviously, you know, a crucial issue for him, but I'm not sure it's such a great issue for us.
I spent the time thinking, why don't you just go back?
Yeah,
and
just take a few, take a week off.
Or in fact, do this afterwards.
Yeah. He's still going to be there in the mountains of Tora Bora.
What do you make of this new type of documentary? Is this the right form for the right question here? I got the feeling that this is a very tricky political situation. Perhaps the kind of jovial approach wasn't the way in.
I don't think it is the way in. I mean, it's basically, it's the Gonzo light style of journalism, isn't it? Where you are the main character in your story. That works sometimes. It doesn't work in other aspects. I think there have been great documentaries made already about the war on terror and the world of Osama bin Laden. But they're being made by people like Errol Morris and Robert Greenwald and Alex Gibney, who won the Oscar for Taxi to the Dark Side,
which is superb, and Iraq in Fragments, which is a beautiful
fantastic
film.
But this isn't it. This is a kind of Benetton ad, really, posing as an investigative documentary. And it's a missed opportunity in both senses of the word. He doesn't find Osama bin Laden, and he doesn't really make us understand the bin Laden mindset.
In a way, I did feel that there was perhaps, it took a while for me to get here, but I thought perhaps that this was for the kids in a way. He did say he was doing this in a way for his unborn child. What kind of world is he bringing him, the child into? In a way, I think maybe this was for school kids. It did seem quite simplistic.
Yeah, it's the sort of thing that I can imagine as a kid being sat down in Double Humanities on a Friday afternoon and being made to watch and thinking it's fine. And it has, you know, I have to say, it has got some nice little bits to it, some nice confrontations. And I particularly like the official who says to him that 9/11 is a Hollywood fraud like the talking pig in Babe, which is alarming, isn't it? That it sort of suggests that the talking pig in Babe was the sort of the trial run for 9/11. And they thought if they can get away with this, then we can get away with 9/11.
Maybe 9/11 was revenge for Babe 2, Pig in the City.
I liked Babe 2, Pig in the City. And I liked it more than this.
Next up, we'll look at a film that may be for young people, but certainly is not for the cyclists amongst us.
Your son seems to be interested in only one thing.
All drivers to your cars, please.
All he talks about.
The final countdown has begun.
All he seems capable of thinking about is automobile racing.
Going into victory lane, the winner, Speed Racer.
Speed Racers, the second of the year's big blockbusters, following up from last week's huge grossing Iron Man. I really enjoyed Iron Man. I was looking forward to Speed Racers. This is the Wachowski brothers, those of The Matrix. Are they back in the real world, Zan?
No, they're as far from the real world as it's possible to get without going to the moon. Again, I think we're probably a bit too old for this. I think I'm exactly 25 years too old for this one. It was like sort of stumbling into an 80s amusement arcade. It was all sort of bright lights and noise, and it made my head hurt.
What is it about?
I don't know.
Oh, good. Right, let's move on. I couldn't make head nor tail nor back nor short nor front nor
side.
It's
about a speed racer whose name is actually Speed Racer, played by Emil Hirsch. And he races at times at quite astonishing speed in cars. It's also got John Goodman in it. It's got Christina Ricci in it. It's one of these films that's got kind of state-of-the-art special effects and very below-par human effects, and that the characters are sort of as deep as a puddle, and they never really convince. It's a sort of cartoony digital playground of a film. It's very loud.
It is. Could you tell it was a Wachowski brothers enterprise? Following on from The Matrix, have they at least kind of brought some kind of auteurist stamp? Because Cannes Film Festival has championed the Wachowskis. They've put The Matrix on there. It suggests that they are, in fact, forging new ground, at least, even if we don't understand what ground it is.
Well, seeing a film like this makes me wonder if The Matrix pulled the wool over people's eyes. The Matrix was talked of in very kind of high-minded terms when it came out. It was seen as an action blockbuster with real hidden depths to it that was really kind of touching on stuff. Maybe it wasn't, but it was a lot of fun. This is like The Matrix with a sort of lobotomy. It's got no pretensions in that area at all, which kind of makes it almost likable at times. It's so over the top, it's so nonsensical that you almost want to just think, I'm just going to be swept along with this and I'm going to go along with it wherever it takes me. But not quite. It sort of turns your brain to mush after a while.
There is, I mean, whatever one says about it, it does have a distinctive look, a colour palette that kind of is both retro and futuristic, both 50s and both comic book and manga style. And some of the way it's shot is, I suppose, at least groundbreaking, with collages happening in the background. It looks like a mix between the Jetsons and Willy Wonka, the Johnny Depp one, and a bit of Fifth Element, a bit of Yellow Submarine. Does that at least impress at some point?
It impresses for the first sort of 10 minutes or so, and then it starts to make your eyes bleed.
Is there a 3D version of this? I kept thinking I should be watching the 3D version.
I felt that I was watching the 3D version, but just without the glasses. So it was just my eyes were strobing all the time. It actually reminded me a little bit of Tron. Do you remember Tron from the early 1980s, which was Disney's kind of first tentative baby step into this sort of brave new world of alternative realities.
Yes, and indeed, I mean, as those two men who play tennis, those stick machines, video games are to today's video games, Grand Theft Auto 5, 6, whatever it is these days, so is this to Tron. I mean, things have moved on. However, the dialogue's got worse.
The dialogue has got worse, hasn't it?
I didn't understand a word anyone was saying. It seemed to be words and sentences, but not as I knew
them. Well, it's from a Japanese manga strip originally, so it looked like the dialogue had been put through on those kind of Google translation engines where it comes back sort of as gobbledygook that almost makes sense but just doesn't.
Also, I think perhaps the most annoying comic duo in the history of Hollywood, the small fat boy who eats sweets and his chimp.
The chimp called Chim Chim. There should be less movies with chimps in, I think.
And if you want to find out more about the enigmatic Wachowski brothers who directed Speed Racers, do check out Damon Wise's excellent background article on guardian.co.uk film. And finally, let's move on to Doomsday, the latest film from British director Neil Marshall. He of The Descent and Dog Soldiers. He likes films with D in the title.
He does, yes. That's always a good starting point for any review. This unfortunately, this almost gets kind of D for achievement. The Descent was fantastic. I love The Descent.
Did you?
I did.
Or those chicks in fleeces?
It wasn't about chicks in fleeces. It was about the terrors of female friendship and betrayal. But The Descent was, I thought, was one of the best horror films in the last sort of 5 years or so. This is like a homage to early 80s cyberpunk B-movies like Escape from New York, Mad Max, even Streets of Fire. And so sort of Marshall is kind of betraying his age here. This is obviously the films that he grew up loving.
And yours.
And mine too, and yours. And I do like those films. I'm very sort of fond of them. And all the ingredients of those films are sort of here in an undigested kind of chunks. We've got the pole dancing punkettes. We've got motorcycle chases, we've got gladiator fights, we've got zombies. The plot basically sends Ronan Mitra, who's a sort of ass-kicking law enforcement officer, to a futuristic quarantine Scotland in search of an antidote to a virus that's sweeping London. And once that's sort of out the way, we've got like this long voiceover from Michael McDowell explaining all this, then it's on to the kind of pole dancing punks. It's all there, and it's all kind of good in its trashy way. And yeah, it never quite gels together. And recycling is all very well, but you kind of want to end up making something new of it. You don't want to sort of produce rubbish, because that surely defeats the object of recycling. And this, even though it's got great bits to it and it's enjoyable, is kind of a bit junky.
What we're about to show you is highly confidential.
Survivors?
Inside the hot zone.
And if there are survivors, there must be a cure.
You're going out there. If there's such a thing as hell on Earth, that's it.
I know what we're looking for.
If it's there, I'll find it. Take us in.
Now.
Once you're over that wall, there's no system, no rules, no backup.
To find a cure...
We're against the clock on this one.
They must return to the world they left behind.
How the hell are we supposed to find anything in this mess?
I'll know when I see it.
This is our city!
I do agree with you. I did enjoy, I kind of relished the trashiness of it. I must say, as a genre, I thought it was doing what it was supposed to be doing on the dustbin lid. And I thought that the body count, the limb count, the kind of roasting of Sean Pertwee, literally on a fire, I mean, in a kind of footballer's kind of way, all kind of worked for me. I eventually, but I could tell that some people in the audience didn't get it. It wasn't working for them. It was only when the third head kind of spun towards me and almost hit me in the face.
Well,
the
it
screen.
Actually kind of clunks off the camera, doesn't it, I think, which is a sort of real fantastic, audacious thing to do. Having spoken about two films that we're probably too old for, this is probably a film that you can actually possibly be too young for. This is a film for late 30-something fanboys. That's its audience. And I imagine younger audiences, weirdly, just thinking, this is just junk. This is just pure trash.
I suppose there's a scene where the leader of the new rave pole dancing punkettes comes on to the Fine Young Cannibals' Good Thing, which I thought, God, blimey, that iPod needs updating.
I know, yeah. It's an old man's film, this, for all of its kind of futuristic glitz and dash and blood and carnage. It's as conservative in its way as a sort of Werther's Original advert.
Zan Brooks, thank you very much. Which of your films would you choose as film of the week?
Oh, God, that's like...
Invidious.
That's like choosing between vinegar and castor oil and mud. But I'll go with the mud, which is Doomsday. I think, you know, in not the best week for cinema, Doomsday is at least enjoyable.
Zan Brooks, thank you very much indeed. And of course, we'll be talking to Neil Marshall a bit later on in this very studio on this very edition of Film Weekly. Now, of course, if you have an opinion, a wisecrack or a pearl of wisdom to pass on or share, the best way to do it is to go to the Film Weekly blog. It's at blogs.guardian.co.uk/film. And that's just what Laz did on John Sayle's Honey Dripper, which we featured in last week's podcast. Laz wrote, "I think if I wanted to seriously hip someone to the work of John Sayle, there'd be wiser choices than Honey Dripper. But for a soul interested in exploring the history of popular music, though," adds Laz, "it would definitely have a place on the reading list." And on John Savage's and Grant G's Joy Division documentary, which we also featured last week on the show, Captain Black wrote on the blog, "I saw the Joy Division doc in Salford about 6 months ago. Although the story of their band and label have been exhaustively documented and fictionalised already, this is the definitive statement." So thanks to Captain Black there and all those who put on our blog their feedback. Comments always most appreciated. Now, you may have heard myself and Zan Brooks discussing Neil Marshall's film Doomsday earlier in our review section. Zan favourably compared it to Mud, but it was nevertheless his film of the week and our choice for you. So we do have for you Neil Marshall, director of Dog Soldiers, The Descent, and now Doomsday, a new sci-fi epic set in the UK, in Scotland and in England, starring Bob Hoskins. Neil, welcome to Film Weekly. I'm always very scared to meet you. I always think you're going to kind of come out of the woodwork. Work at me, some kind of maddened beast.
It's a false perception about people who make horror movies that they're supposed to be scary. But I think all the horror movie directors that I've met are really, really nice.
Yeah,
people.
You're a calm, smiling, kind of benign presence. Even
oh, it's a false front. No, there's the kind of dark heart beats within. I think that's what it is.
your new film is Doomsday, as we know, and I mean, I have to say, Neil, I think it's insane. I kind of loved it. I thought it was mad, barking, more barking than Dog Soldiers, in fact, your previous work. More kind of scary and kind of tense than The Descent, the work before. So you kind of, I think you've taken it up to 11 with Doomsday, to use a quaint old expression.
Yeah. Well, that was always the intention. I wanted to go very over the top with it and make it full of mayhem, chaos and carnage. And, you know, I didn't hold back in any way, shape or form with that. So... You know, I think it's like an 18 certificate in this country, and that's absolutely what it deserves. I wasn't necessarily trying to make a horror movie with it, but it has horrific stuff in it.
It certainly does. Is it the most violent movie ever made in the UK?
You know, it could well be. There's not much competition.
No, I mean, there isn't. I'm thinking of, say, Straw Dogs, which has, you know, one moment or one scene of great violence, or Clockwork Orange, which has great moments of violence, or even Long Good Friday, but not from the start. Is there this kind of sustained level of kind of heads flying, limbs happening, Sean Pertwee being cooked to death? I mean, it's amazing.
There's certainly a lot more, you know, decapitations and such like that in this film than I think any other British film ever made. I set out to make an action movie, but within a kind of 2008 context, you know, of the audiences are prepared to watch a lot more.
It seemed to me that, I mean, that actually the last time I spoke to you was just after The Descent had been released.
Yeah.
And that sent then, unfortunately, the next day, this very next day, I think the July the 7th bombings happened.
Yes.
And there was your film, The Descent, on that number 30 bus in Tavistock Square, gnarled and kind of mangled. And it was in all the pictures. It was an awful way of having your film promoted. And I think the quote was absolute terror, The Descent.
It was the total film quote, you know, outright terror written on the side of the bus that blew up. It was just like the most appalling piece of bad publicity you could have asked for, but at the same time, just even regarding it in that way is a horrible thing to think about.
No, absolutely. But when I was watching Doomsday, I thought, well, God, you know, this awful thing has happened to Neil's film. In a way, obviously, it was awful what happened to every victim on that day. But
yeah.
I think maybe did it scar you, and you thought, you know, some horror was unleashed on your. On your bus or on the post, did you then kind of up the? Is that what made you want to go? Well, I'm going to unleash some horror back in Doomsday.
Not deliberately so. I mean, I was hugely affected by that. I mean, it was the morning after that we'd had the premiere and the party that we all woke up to find out that these explosions and some of the people who were at the party kind of just missed tube trains that had been hit. So I mean, it was a weird few days. And then, of course, the film is about people being trapped underground, and then in reality, there was people trapped underground. So. People didn't want to go and see that at the cinema that weekend, and it really affected the gross of the movie in the UK. But at the same time, it was like usually well received, and you know, it has gained its reputation since then. But I didn't sort of think with Doomsday I was going to make any kind of, you know, bizarre statement about all that kind of thing, because it's not. I just wanted to make a piece of mindless. Entertainment, and that's what it is.
Yeah, and yet there are sort of political overtones in it. I'd say this film and Dog Soldiers, they both got kind of militia involved. They've both kind of soldiers have gone feral and gone mad. And, you know, we've seen a lot of soldier and war films since Dog Soldiers, actually. We've seen a lot more, you know, in that time. You know, we are at war, and your film deals with a war of sorts, be it on virus, be it on kind of a terror of sorts. So, I mean, clearly the military is something that intrigues you.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of kind of political machinations going on in this movie, which I never dealt with before. And I just liked the idea. It was fun making a film about the British Prime Minister and his associates in a way that, you know, the PM has just never filmed. You know, I treated it more like it was an episode of 24 or something like that, you know, yeah. Secret underground bases and all that kind of stuff. I thought had more fun with it.
Yeah, it did. I mean, you wrote it as well, I presume.
Yes. Yeah.
It's no insult to say that it's of a genre piece of writing. It's not the world's greatest dialogue, is it? When Bob Hoskins comes in and goes, it's all going tits up. But there's some sort of magnificence to it. I loved it. I mean, it was making people unsure whether to laugh at that point, or was it cheesy, or was it bad?
Well, I think people don't really clue into the joke. Of, you know, the movie straight away. It takes a while just to grow on them where it is. It isn't meant to be some like dark statement. The idea that it's taken Scottish devolution to like the most extreme extent, slightly unfair criticism towards the film. That's not really what it's about, but whatever. It's just fun. It's just, you know, how far will a government go to contain a virus and quarantine and save its own neck, really? And I just thought that was funny, exploring the most extreme possibilities.
Well, joking aside, we mentioned about sort of how we make a lot of romantic comedies and period things. Sometimes they make their money back and they don't. There's a huge audience for this sort of thing here in the UK. I mean, but this is actually so insane and so well done. So it fulfills its kind of genre parameters so well that it can't fail to make its money back, I'd have thought, even if it is $30 million, $28 million.
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, I think that there is, you know, I think British audiences want to go and see other, you know, Brit actors or Brit stars in a British context going out there and being heroic and action-packed and stuff like that. We don't get to see that very often. So, you know, I definitely think that we want to go and see that kind of stuff. And not necessarily in a comic vein, but go out there and just be, you know, mental.
Yeah, and if you want to see Sean Pert we roasted alive, if you saw Botched, for example, his movie before this and thought he deserved roasting alive, well, he gets his comeuppance here in Doomsday.
Yeah, well, I like to give him his just desserts.
Yeah, he's very good for you, Sean Pertwee. He was in Dog Soldiers. He wasn't in The Descent, was he?
He wasn't in The Descent, no. We couldn't manage to get him in that. But if we had done, he would have died horribly, I'm sure.
at the hands of all those girls.
Yeah.
Well, it is Doomsday. The director is Neil Marshall. We think it's the most violent film ever made in the UK. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Well, that's all we've got time for on this episode of Film Weekly. If you want to read more from my good self and my esteemed colleagues, do pick up a copy of The Observer each Sunday or go to guardian.co.uk/film. Until next week, when I'll be sunning myself on the Croisette coming to you live from the Cannes Film Festival. Au revoir.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.